CliffCentral.com.
All right, very nice. There's a little Lady Gaga for you this morning. It's Thursday, CliffCentral.com, and Thursday can only mean one thing. It means that we are going to do the burning platform. We're going to do it because that's what we do on a Thursday. The burning platform is brought to you by Nando's. It's our chance to catch up on all those things which are going on in the world around us. This morning, I'm very pleased that we are joined by somebody who I have wanted to have on the show for the longest time. He is Richard Stain, and he has written a book called Seven Votes, which is actually a fascinating story about South Africa's history, something which, again, I'm embarrassed to admit, I don't know terribly much about that period, but there was a narrow decision made in Parliament to go to war in 1939, which led to a seismic upheaval, that's the only way to put it, in the 1940s. And obviously, what happened in South Africa was overshadowed by what was happening internationally with the war and everything else. But it was massively, massively portentous for what would occur going forward in South Africa's history. It was the beginning also of a resurgent nationalism, particularly among Afrikaners. There was a whole lot of political strife between the South African Party, the SAP under Smuts, in the early 30s, and then the nationalists, which were growing in strength under, at that stage, Malan and people like that. So we'll talk a little bit about that because I think it's useful for us to have some context on exactly what the origins of the system that we inherited post the war were and precisely how tenuous the grasp on power was for either of the parties before 1948 or after. And I think somebody who's spent an enormous amount of time looking into this and someone who is much more well-versed in these things than I am is precisely the man who we have on the show this morning. So a little bit of history, a little bit about his book, and then we'll ask him what he thinks of the current machinations of our politicians, what he thinks of all the insanity that we see both locally and internationally when it comes to the news. He is Richard Stain. Richard, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Morning, Gareth. Nice. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for writing this book. It's really, really interesting to see just how narrow a margin change sometimes has to run through. And tell us about Seven Votes. I mean, I paraphrased some parts of what Herzog was up to at the time about what was going on with Smuts. This was obviously a time that preceded apartheid, but laid the groundwork in many ways for what would be 4 or 5 decades of enormous change in South Africa afterwards. Give us an idea of what the spark was that made you write this book.
Gareth, the spark came actually a long time ago when I read a book by an Afrikaner historian, Ut van Wyk, called Faith Dar, 5 Days, which described one of the most dramatic moments in South African parliamentary history, which was the war vote of September 1939. But and the more that was, as you quite correctly say, an absolutely seismic moment in South African political history, which really set the parameters, the trends for the next 40, 50 years until the democracy in 1994, or majority rule, shall I say, in 1994. What happened was politics was very much in the hands of whites throughout the 1930s. We'd come through a very serious depression. In the 1930s, the economy was recovering, but South Africa the Prime Minister of South Africa at the time was the nationalist JBM Herzog, and he was in a fusion government with General Smuts, right, which had come about because South Africa left the gold standard in the 1930s because of the economic depression. And that led to an economic recovery in the 1930s, but politics was very much in the hands of, it was an uneasy sort of marriage, if you like, between the Herzog nationalists and the Smuts South African Party. The elephant in the room at the time was the relationship with Britain and what would happen if Britain, war clouds were gathering over Europe, what would happen if Britain went to war against Hitler? Mm-hmm. And it came, there was a Herzog forced through the cabinet in about in the mid-30s, 1930s, a declaration that South Africa would remain neutral and would not take sides in the war, which the cabinet agreed to. But as the war, as Hitler's intentions became more and more obvious, Smuts changed his mind and said, look, we have to uphold our obligations to the Commonwealth and go to war on Britain's side.
You know, this is fascinating. Sorry to interrupt you, but we're talking about history that's less than 100 years ago. And many South Africans have a very, let's be generous here, a minuscule appreciation for just how complicated that time was. I mean, there were nationalist party people who were pro Hitler's Nazis. There were people in Smuts's, the Supper, as they called them, the Afrikaans people referred to as a sup or a nut, a South African party or a nationalist, who were very much pro-Britain and were ready to get into the war and were gung-ho about going to fight. But there were people who were also hugely sympathetic to the Nazis in this country.
Absolutely. Well, there were sort of, you could divide Afrikaner nationalism. You see, the Afrikaners come through the Boer War, and there was very deep resentment of Britain.
Sure.
It still lingered. It was only 20 years later, 30 sure. years later.
And that's why when people say, oh, you know, black people have got to get over apartheid, I mean, Afrikaans people have never got over the Anglo-Boer War, so it seems a little trite.
Absolutely right. I mean, many still haven't, but a great many more have. Yes, so they were. That's why I say it was the elephant in the room. The one issue that threatened to split the country apart, which it did in the war vote. And Herzog went into the parliamentary vote. He was the prime minister, a dictatorial man, used to getting his own way, as was Smuts. And these two sort of giant figures went against each other on the war vote. Herzog asked for a declaration of neutrality. Smuts said, proposed an amendment saying that South Africa would go to war effectively and on Britain's side uphold its obligations to the Commonwealth. And he won by a majority of 13 votes. Now, if seven more nationalists had voted for Herzog, South Africa would not have gone to war and our history would have been very different. So that's the title of the book, Seven Votes.
It's fascinating. Can you tell us just what you think? And I know that this is not in your wheelhouse, but it's still worth thinking about. What might have happened if Herzog had won that vote and we had stayed neutral during World War II?
Well, it's a subject that I've thought about quite a lot. I mean, South Africa was unpopular enough after the war, as we will perhaps come to later, because of its racial policies. Can you imagine if we had allied ourselves with Herzog, with Hitler, lost the war?
Or pretended to be neutral, sure.
And, well, neutral, neutral, but still assisting Hitler in many ways by being neutral, dropped the Commonwealth, as it were. Can you imagine how more unpopular we would have been? It was interesting because after we went to war, twice Herzog went back to Parliament and asked for that vote to be rescinded, and twice Smuts, that was 1942, twice Smuts won the vote by a larger margin. And then America came into the war, and very quickly it was obvious which side was going to win the war, even though it was going to take a long time. So it was clear that Smuts had made the right choice internationally.
Yeah.
South Africa played a minor but important role in the Allied armies and air forces and navies.
I know that both my grandfathers went to war and fought for the Allies against Hitler, and I think that it was something that they didn't really have much of a say in, but they were proud of their contribution there, and certainly both of them used to complain post 1948 what they think South Africa might have looked like if the Nationalists hadn't won that important election. What might have happened if Smuts had remained our prime minister rather than Malan?
Well, again, you know, that's one of the great what-ifs.
Might we not have had apartheid? Might we have had a different dispensation? Maybe we would have had changes brought in earlier that would have brought black people into the mainstream of politics?
Well, Gareth, that is exactly my point. I mean, Smuts, let's face it, was also segregationist. The United Party, his United Party, was very conservative. It also faced opposition not only from African nationalists, but also from the Indian community, which was growing and becoming more and more influential, the colored community in the Cape. Segregation grew throughout the 30s, and it grew again after the war. And that's when the broad parameters of South African politics, post-war politics, took place in the 1940s. So it's easy to – Smuts was 80 by the time he lost the 78. He died in 80. 78 by the time he was too old. He was not a liberal. He was too old to change his mindset. So to me, I don't think we would have one thing Smuts would have done was to have brought black political leaders into some sort of serious discussion. There was the Native Representative Council with some very distinguished people on board, which Smuts was talking to, but at arm's length. Mm-hmm. When the Nationalists came in with Milan, they abolished the Native Representative Council, and effectively dialogue was stifled. So I think, I'm not sure, we probably had a form of apartheid, but I think it was avoidable. And the message of this book is really that the white people, white politicians, consistently turned their backs on all sorts of initiatives, developments that sprouted in the 40s but never got beyond 48, because that's when the nationalists came in and apartheid.
Pumi Mashiko is, as always, our guest host on cliffcentral.com for The Burning Platform. And Pumi, I'm sorry I had to jump in. You know what a history fan I am. I had to find out, because I'm going to read the book from cover to cover, no doubt, but I needed to just get some stuff off my chest and ask a few questions. I know you've been bristling with one or two as well. What do you want to ask, Richard?
Well, deeply fascinated by the landscape that vote created, in terms of, for the bigger population, which is what precipitated the National Party rising into power in 1948. Is it because of that incredible strife and the narrowness of that vote?
For me, I'm not sure if that was the reason, but you know, what changed South Africa was when we went to war, the economy took off. South Africa became the workshop of Africa. It provided new armaments, it provided food, the industry took off, and of course there was segregation in those days, urban segregation, but that just, the pass laws sort of were ignored. Africans from the reserves streamed to the towns, and of course the politically minded among them launched, well, the ANC was revived under Dr. A.B. Zuma, and that's when the ANC, the Youth League, was founded under Mandela, Tambo, and Sisulu. That all took off. So that was the sprouting, that was the reaction to the economic changes that were coming, and it was that, I think, that really sparked off the African political resistance. It wasn't so much going to war, it was the economic consequences of going to war that started that immense pressure on the South African government.
Listen, I mean, this is a period of South African history where really there might have been very few South Africans who actually had the vote, but there was as much ferocity in Parliament for going this way or that. Obviously, what happened subsequent, I mean, Smuts did die shortly after that 48 election anyway, so even if he had won, he might not have been Prime Minister for very long, and I don't know who his successor might have been. Do you have any suspicion about who that might have been and whether that person might have had a more liberal bent?
Well, look, the great question, I mean, the man who was the who was at Smuts's right hand throughout the war was J.H. Hoffmeyr, one of the brightest, along with Smuts, probably the two cleverest Afrikaners we've ever produced. I mean, he was a Rhodes Scholar at 16, I think, and sure. He was principal of Wits at 24. The first principal of Wits at the age of 24, administrator of the Transvaal at 28. He was Smuts's right-hand man. He actually ran South Africa during the war while Smuts kind of worried about the military side of it and the inter- and
it's worth just pointing out that Smuts was basically the Allied boss for a little while and was Churchill's successor should anything have happened to him in Britain. He was also doing amazing things like thinking about what we would do post-war with, you know, establishing the United Nations and such things. So he was an incredible, very, very smart Renaissance man of the 20th century in many ways.
Yes, he was. I was just correct you there. You're right in saying many people thought he was going to take over from Britain. It was sort of dinner party chat, but
yes,
he never would have.
No, sure.
But you know what I mean. He was up there.
He was certainly afforded certain respect that that no other leader from any other country was at the time. Yeah. He was one of Churchill's best friends, and he did address both houses of Parliament and so on. You know, he was
all of that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just getting back to your question about who would have succeeded. There was a lot of dissatisfaction with returning servicemen, with the state of, I mean, warfare. All wartime governments have a problem in the post-war election. Churchill was flung out of power. A lot of dissatisfaction. You know, there's shortages of everything, and prices went up, and all that sort of thing. So the United Party after 8 years was ripe to be replaced, and the blame, and Smuts lost the 48 election partly because he thought he was going to win and didn't pay careful enough attention to the electorate, but Hoffmeyr, who he thought was his heir apparent, was a far more liberal individual than Smuts was. Unfortunately, 2 months after the election, Hoffmeyr died at 54 of overwork.
Sure.
If he'd lived, the big question in South African politics is what would he have done? Would he have led the United Party into a more liberal dispensation or not? In the event, Smuts died, and they played for a safe pair of hands in J.G.N. Strauss, who was really not up to the nationalists. And in fact, I think all the trends were pointing towards a nationalist victory at that stage. And as apartheid tightened its grip and the world criticized South Africa, the National Party's grip on South Africa became stronger. So would we, if Smuts had lived, would we have had a different dispensation? I think we would have had apartheid eventually, is my view. But that is arguable.
Pums?
I think so too, because I think even before the Nationalist Party, there were many, you talk about the Native Council. Remember that coming out of a colonial history, black people were never, ever part of the governance of any of these countries. And in fact, for a long time, a lot of the colonialists and white people in all over the world did not believe that the native people of any country could have a say or should have a say, or that they were sophisticated enough to want to have a say. So that would have, it would inevitable. I mean, just the policies leading up even to 1948, it became very, very hard after 1948. But all of those policies, like the land tax, all of those things were already in place, and that's where they were moving. That's just how people thought in the day.
And
I mean, would quite agree with that.
And probably with the forceful personalities of people like Strydom and Verwoerd, who were formidable, if nothing else. I mean, certainly their political adversaries would have given that moniker. Those two pushed hard. There was no way that, even if they weren't in power, that they wouldn't have been pushing for these things in opposition and would have gained enormous popularity as a result of it.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the point to understand is that the war changed the world completely. The post-war world became race became a big issue. And as you say, it was that South Africa, that change in international attitude that South Africa was very slow to appreciate. Smuts got hammered at the UN for South Africa's racial policies. And of course, as soon as the nationalists got there, the pressure just intensified. Neither side could come to terms with the fact that black people had to be brought into the political polity at the time. That, in my view, and it's the message of the book, is the great chance that we missed, because there were some outstanding people in the Native Representative Council, and they were knocking on a closed door all the time.
So I'm afraid at this point we'll have to leave history, because a lot of people listen to this part of the show to get an update on what's going on now, and there's so much to talk about this morning. So woulda, coulda, shoulda, this is why books like yours are so interesting for us to read, because, you know, if only we'd made the right decisions earlier on, we would perhaps have averted so much of the bloodshed and the ugliness of what happened later on, as the nationalist grip started to falter on South Africa later on. And maybe, you know, maybe you can't expect history to go anyway but the way that it's gone, and maybe we learn something by reading books like yours. I certainly think so. But here we are, and we're now stuck in 2021. We've got an ANC who've been trying to manage a pandemic. We've got an international reputation which has suffered somewhat over the last couple of years, when it was at its apogee, probably during the Mandela administration. How do you think, with the lessons of history, the ANC will be judged when someone like you writes their story in another 70 years?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a huge question. I mean, And Gareth, I'm sort of, I used to be politically involved as a journalist in the you know, in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and I'm no longer now. So I sit and watch, and like most of the country, just shake my head, because when I look at the good intentions of people like Mandela and Tambo in the 80s and A.B. Zuma, these were the moderates that you know, they were not extremists. They didn't want to drive the white men into the sea. A couple of the Communist Party did, but they wanted to be drawn into the South African political into the polity, and they were capable and able. And if we had only brought those leaders and their followers into some sort of political dispensation, I don't think we would have ended up in the shambles we're in today, where unfortunately we had this period, this honeymoon period under Mandela, but then, kind of as has happened in many countries, greed took over, and you know, we ended up with state capture and a complete sort of hollowing out of the state. And I just shake my head. What I do say is that, and one of the reasons, I mean, I've written Smuts, books on Smuts and Botha, and with allusions to Churchill. There was definite leadership in those days. I don't see much leadership now. People took tough decisions. They weren't popular. They took tough decisions.
On that note, Pumi, yes, go ahead.
I mean, I just, looking at history and where we are in South Africa, I think the average time period that post-liberation movements remain in power, especially in Africa, is around 20 years. And here the ANC is on the cusp, 26 years, and they're disintegrating. I think that's the biggest thing that we can see from history, is that 20 years, and they've lived there 20 years, and they have failed to change and recalibrate for what it means to be a governing party.
But I mean, you know, Museveni and Museveni in Uganda is at 35. I mean, you can't get rid of the system in Zimbabwe. So I think 20 years is an underestimate. But the sad thing is that, you know, politics now, I mean, we're getting the wrong sort of people into politics. Youngsters like of your age, your generation, should be driving these old ANC politicians out of office and saying, listen, your time is gone. It's time we took over the country. There's so much talent here.
Listen, you're banging Pumi's drum here, because she's been saying for the longest time that unless we take responsibility at community level and start making changes in our own environment and do it at that stage and then develop up the tree into international politics, she's saying the same thing you are. But I wanted to ask you, Richard, and by the way, let me just fill everybody in here, because you've got a very distinguished CV, which I didn't indicate at the beginning. We're speaking to Richard Steyn. He's a graduate of Stellenbosch University. He's been a journalist for many years. He was also a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University from 85 to 86, editor-in-chief of The Star from 1990 to 1995. What an incredible period to have been a newspaper editor. Served as Standard Bank's Director of Corporate Affairs and Communications in the late 90s to the early 2000s, and has been writing books. He's written bestsellers about Jan Smuts, Unafraid of Greatness, Churchill and Smuts, The Friendship, and has established a loyal readership. So it's a great pleasure to finally have you on the show, and there's so many things I want to ask you. While we're on the ANC, though, there are things the ANC learnt, bad things, from the Nationalist Party. Often the people that you loathe the most, they lurk in the back of your mind while you're busy drafting your own well-made plans. And I can't help thinking, when I look at some of the things that the ANC does today, that a lot of that is a hangover from the Nationalists. I mean, we still have laws on the books that are not the kind of laws that a country like us should have. Some of them run contrary to the Constitution. But some of the behavior that we see evidenced in the ANC and even opposition politicians today is behavior that would not be out of place in the old National Party.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Africans, white, black and white, suffer from this big man syndrome. We defer to these great figures. And I mean, the ANC is, this man with a black hat that keeps telling us we've got to do and so on. And ANC has many authoritarian tendencies, and I think they've been nurtured over time. and probably we've got a role in that. So, yes, you're absolutely right. I wouldn't argue. There are lots of laws on the statute book which have simply been taken over. And in a true democracy would have been debated and thrown out. So, yes, I agree with you. There's a great authoritarian streak in the ANC. But the fact is that when push comes to shove, there's not a lot of decision-making. There's a lot of throwing their weight around, but not a lot of decision-making. And that's why, for me, it's important for your generation to take over from old boys like mine.
Hey, Pumi and I are no spring chickens anymore either.
Exactly. We've missed the boat.
All right, can I ask both of you, because we had a fairly historic thing happen yesterday in the United States, and again, Richard, from your point of view as a historian and a journalist, and Pumi, because you watched the whole thing and you've been paying attention to the story probably a little more closely than I have found myself slightly disaffected by the events of what has happened in the last year in American politics. But in many ways, this is a tremendous and historic moment. We saw a socially distanced inauguration of an ever more polarized American polity. We see a president who's now going to talk about unity, and he's going to try his best to cobble together from a ruinous political dispensation of the last 4 years, and certainly something that has made people feel that you're either with us or against us, depending on which side you're on. How do you interpret this in the big, long lens of history, and what do you make of America going forward?
Well, Gareth, I think one must understand that Trump is a sort of an end point of a process that has been in carry on now for some 30 years. I mean, it was brought to a head by the economic crisis in 2008. And Trump got in on basically America votes for the person who provides the most jobs and the lowest tax rates. And Trump got in. He was an aberration. Nobody thought he would come close to being president. He was as much of a disaster as his opponents thought he would be. But one thing he did, and why 70 million people have voted for him, is that because the lot of the average, and I'm talking particularly white Rust Belt voters, voted for him because there was more money in their pockets, they paid less taxes, and they had good economic reasons for voting for this man who was totally unfitted to be a politician because he was absorbed only by himself, saw everything through his own lens. It was sort of accident of history that he got thrust into this role. Who knows where it will go now? I think America's institutions have held. Biden is the antithesis of trust, an old timer, very old for an American president, who is a centrist, who is going to try and bring America together. But I can't really foresee whether he can mend that a deeply, deeply divided America. But I do see America reasserting its role in the world on climate change, in NATO. And I think we'll see more alliance building between America and Europe, which is crucial if the West, as it were, is going to keep China, an emerging China, a much smaller Russia at bay.
Pums, what do you think, based on what you saw
yesterday?
I think
it's going to take a long time. So I really, really enjoyed listening to Biden kind of set the tone. He sounded like a grown-up. He was like dad, kind of going, stop it now, this is over. But I do think that what's happened in America is that they've stumbled and they've lost their footing. I think even in the world, you talk about an emerging China, I think it's going to take a very, very long time for them to regain the standing that they've always had. And in fact, I don't know if they ever will. I think what we might be seeing is the ending of an empire. You know, it might be, this is it. I don't know if America, I think the divisions are going to remain internally. And if the internal divisions remain, unfortunately, that takes away the attention of the administration from everything else that happens in the world, because they've got to keep home. They've got to keep the home together. And that's what's going to happen for a while to come. I think that's going to be...
I think the crucial thing is, where do those 74 million Trump voters go? Does the Republican Party regain them, or do they... What happens? And that's why this impeachment trial is so interesting, because if Trump is taken out of the equation, cannot stand again, and can't play golf as much as he used to, he might lose a bit of enthusiasm. But if he still is up and running and runs again in 74, I think your scenario is certainly possible.
You know, what's so interesting too is, and you indicated some aspect of this now, is that there are two ways for the Republican Party to go. If they embrace Trumpism and they try to bring him back, or they try to bring back someone similar to him, they may have an opportunity to kind of relight their fires in that respect. But to imagine that someone like Paul Ryan or even Mitt Romney would ever fill stadia up and garner the kind of enthusiasm that Trump did, rightly or wrongly, I mean, we can criticize it all we like, but that's what he did. He was tremendously popular with a large swathe of the people. I don't think the Republicans can turn the clock back on this thing.
I don't think so, too.
I don't know that the Republicans...
Trump has broken the grand old party.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that the Republicans will ever be able to win the popular vote in America again.
I think that we mustn't take lightly also the pardon of Steve Bannon, because what Steve Bannon tends to do, and this is where those 70-odd million votes are going to go, is he knows how to ferment new leadership in those and supports it, you know, puts money behind it, lobbies for it. I think that pardon for Steve Bannon is a dangerous little...
Is he to Trump what Karl Rove was to George W. Bush?
I think he is, and I think if the impeachment goes ahead and Trump does go to jail, Steve Bannon's going to find somebody else. He'll find a new person to put up, because that's what history does. If the tools of the day don't work, history always finds new tools.
Just remember, Pumi, that Steve Bannon actually hasn't gone on trial yet, basically for stealing money. if a court finds him guilty, I'm not sure his pardon may then work retrospectively, but I doubt whether America is going to take much notice of Bannon himself. There are other Bannons around, but I think Steve Bannon, actually my view is that he's very much a busted flush and he's damned lucky to have been let off by Trump. I hope I'm right.
Let me ask you about something else that you...
I hope you're right, too.
Let me ask you about something else you kind of breezed past a second ago, and both of you have, I'm sure, very strong views on this, but we are looking at perhaps the end of the great American era, and we, if that is true, and we are entering a new phase, and China is at the forefront of that phase, I was more than slightly irritated to read that the country that gave us this virus is also the only country in the world that saw growth in its economy in 2020. Now, forgive me for my cynicism, but this does play into all the conspiracy theories, and it does make you start to think that perhaps China is not only willfully being destructive to the rest of the world in respect of, you know, stuff outside of creating the virus. We know that they are. There's industrial espionage going on. They are tremendously strategic. They think long term. This Belt and Road Initiative is something which is steamrolling ahead, whether people like it or not. What kind of world would the Chinese Empire deliver to our children and our children's children? Because it'll still be in play for a little while, but possibly within another generation or two, there'll be a different dispensation. What would that world look like, do you think?
Gareth, I can't answer that. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't think much of the Chinese. I don't like our relationship with China. It's an authoritarian system, and it, I think, contains within it the seeds of its own destruction. I hope that might happen. But I don't think the American era is coming to an end. I think it's come to an end and came to an end at least a decade ago, if not more. But I think, you know, Europe has a bigger economy than America's combined. I think if America and China, America and Europe can ally with each other again, that is a tremendously powerful block. But I think, you know, Trump has kind of disaggregated, disunited that potential bulwark against China. China, remember, has not a lot of resources, minerals, things of its own. It actually wants to control a section of the world. I'm not sure that it's bent on world domination. It certainly wants to control South Asia, or Asia, not South Asia. And to do that, I think you need countervailing blocks. And I think that's where that's going to be the interesting development over the next 30, 40 years. I don't see China wanting to run the world. I think they want to run an area of the world. And I think the question is, how do the West and the non-aligned countries get together to keep the Chinese at bay?
And certainly they see us in Africa as just a basket of resources. They're not very interested in us. They don't take us seriously as partners.
No, they're plundering us. Yeah.
Pums?
I think it'll be fascinating to see the crop of politicians and political thinking that comes up in this new era, because that's the other thing, you know, the thing that's at play is the minds of the people that make the decisions and where they go. And I think the one thing that could be a stumbling block for China's kind of ambitions is the fact that young people today, or young politicians, are vastly different. They don't take very much to the strong man authoritarian type of politics. They are very is argumentative, not even the right word, but they really do consider all sorts of permeations of the decisions that they make, and I think that is going to be one of the things that's going to
Hong Kong, us all. Yeah. Young people in Hong Kong. Yeah,
that's a very good point. Do you think that we're going to see more war under a Biden administration than we did under Trump? For all of his foibles and for all the things that you rightly said about the accident of history that has propelled him into this position, Donald Trump didn't start a war. So do you think we might go back to the American war machine being, cranked into full volume?
But Donald Trump sold arms to the Arabians, to Saudi Arabia, and that is something that also, you know, foments war. It may not be that he started war, but what he has done is he's upset the apple cart in a very precarious kind of peace that was happening over there.
Yeah. Look, it's an interesting thing. I mean, America, you know, is in a sense, has been a policeman of the world, and that involves doing things that, you know, are pretty illiberal. Trump, Obama understood that America could no longer be as warmongering, in quotation marks, as it was, and sort of switched tactics from really to drone warfare. I don't think Biden is going to be, I think he will be very similar to Obama. I agree that Trump didn't start any wars, but he certainly veered all over the place, but never knew whether he was going to start a war or not, but he didn't. He also, when push came to shove, withdrew his troops from many countries which were in fact trying to keep a reasonable peace in the, particularly in the Middle East. So it's difficult to see, but I do think that warfare from now on is going to be more drone-led I doubt if we're going to see large armies marching to each other's countries, but certainly war is not going to stop.
This is interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the news yesterday, this was at like 9 o'clock South African time last night, that the Biden administration changed the title of U.S. Ambassador to Israel into U.S. Ambassador to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza, which indicates a policy shift and shows that the new administration doesn't consider any parts of these areas as Israeli territory. So already there's a change in tone there. And, you know, again, you could say that we were starting to make at least a little bit of progress with the Israeli and Arab world conversations. I suppose that'll change now too, because of the relationship mm-hmm. that the Democratic Party has with the Palestinians.
Well, I'm sure. I mean, the Palestinian Authority hasn't spoken to Trump for 3 years, so the development in relations have really been out of fear of Iran, and not because of any great new thinking in Israel and Palestine. It's going to be interesting. Let's see if they move the capital of Israel back to, or the American embassy in Israel back to Tel Aviv. I don't see that happening. So, you know, you take two steps forward, one step forward, two steps back. Who knows what's going to happen in the Middle East? But I do think there's a bloc forming against Iran, the Sunni Shiite split is growing and developing, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what role America plays in that cauldron.
Who would China prefer? Would they have been happy to see Biden come in as they have, or would they have been happier to have Trump back? And who would Iran like, and who do you think Russia would like?
No, well, I think all three would prefer Biden. Russia wouldn't. Russia is a sort of rogue state now. The more disruption in America, the better for Russia, and particularly for Putin. But I think China would prefer to deal with an experienced poll like Biden than with the mercurial Trump. I think most people who deal with America are happy to have somebody there whose actions they can anticipate and gauge or predict, rather than this completely unpredictable Trump who saw everything through his own
ego.
You know, his own what was best for him, not for the country.
Can I ask you, Pums? I mean, do you agree with that first of all?
I do. I'm trying to remember the name of the military strategist that Putin has, and just talking about war and where war is going, that wars are no longer going to be about dozens and dozens and dozens of troops on the ground, but really around the strategy and the technology.
And I suppose the social media channels. So, Richard, first of all, there are compliments flooding in for you. Connor says he's read all of your books, and thank you for writing them. They are absolutely brilliant. That's Connor, who's listening to us now. Lots of other people saying that they love your books. Tracy says, Richard's an amazing guest. What wonderful insight. Thank you. And here, if we could bring things back to South Africa, because we've only got a few minutes left. There are pressing domestic issues. We've got this vaccine which is supposedly coming, although we don't know how we're going to pay for it. The politicians are talking about raising taxes, further taxes, on the population in order to pay for the vaccines. How does that make the two of you feel?
Well, I suppose...
Richard, you go first.
Sorry, for me, you go.
No, you go first, Richard, because I have...
I think.
Well, I think
you would get the vaccine first anyway, I suppose, Richard, because you're slightly older than us. So you go first with your comments as well.
Look, I mean, how much does a vaccine cost? Damn it! I mean, I don't think the tax is going to be swinging. If it came to a question of, you know, paying an extra percent on VAT for 6 months or something, I wouldn't mind. I mean, the main thing we've got to kill is virus. A short-term, once-off tax, if it gets rid of the virus, I think would be worth it. It'd save us enormous amount of money going forward. So, I mean, if we've really run out of money, and I don't know that we have, I think we can find the resources without a tax, but if push comes to shove, let's have a damn tax, but let's get rid of the virus.
I think we could find the money without a tax. But our politicians are lazy, and the tax is an easy solve. Unfortunately, it's an easy solve in the short term, but if they do raise the taxes, I think that will be the final nail in the ANC's coffin.
A permanent tax would be, I agree with you, but I'm talking about a once-off.
Yeah,
they're not that smart. They wouldn't go once off.
Don't tempt politicians with a good time by telling them they can raise another tax, especially under the stealthy sobriquet of thinking that it's going to help people fight a disease. I mean, we know that this government, they cannot manage money. And I see SAA were boasting on social media about their planes yesterday, and they got taken down by everybody on social media. Everybody was making fun of them. Did you see that? Did either of you see any of this?
I
didn't see that.
Okay, so apparently, I mean, I'll try and find the story quickly. It'll just give me a second. So apparently, SAA posted a beautiful landing performed with their A340-300, and they mentioned this on, I think it was one of the social media, maybe TikTok or something. Anyway, people's comments were, I thought you people were broke. Who's buying you the data to post this? A rare video of an SAA plane flying. Where's the 500 billion? Where are you getting the money for data? So
well, as it occurred to you, I mean, if we took the money that we're putting into SAA, that would easily cover the cost of a virus vaccine, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Ace Magashule, let's just talk about him for a second, because the factionalism inside the ANC still threatens to tear it apart at every given moment. And, you know, people in the ANC are just whistling past the graveyard here, pretending there's nothing going on. What is your feeling on factionalism here? I know Pumi, so I'll let her go after you because there are updates. But, Richard, what do you make of all of this?
Yeah, I mean, words fail me. Frankly, I'd rather keep out of it. I deplore what's happening. I can see why. It's because we have a very weak NEC, and I think there are just too many people involved for them to take the sort of action that we all know needs to be taken. But, Pumi, let me defer to you. What are you? You have a better idea.
You know, it's... Oh, shame, man. It's such a joke. It's such a joke because I think that there's a little bit of the tail wagging the dog there. Cyril, unfortunately, is not a strong enough leader for the ANC. He's not, and I've said this before, unlike Tambo, who held the party by the scruff of its neck, you know. Thabo Mbeki tried, and I think Thabo Mbeki unfortunately created a weak party by having the people he had around him. But Cyril is failing to wrangle the beast. He's failing to hold people to account, even at the party level. And then he's got all of the other things happening around him. You know, he's got failing economic policies. He's got a surging population because of all the wars around us, because of their bad foreign policy, and then he's unable to hold his ministers.
So you mean he's not a big man leader? If we had a big
need a big tough leader. We really don't need a big tough leader. We need a smart leader. We need somebody who's smart.
Yes, who knows smart, how to
push
you.
And
he's too smart probably to make a tough decision. Knows what will happen.
Tough decisions. This is what we need now.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time for this morning's Burning Platform. But Richard, great pleasure to have you on. Pumi, always useful to have your insights, and thank you very much. Poor Pumi sent me a message for this morning that she was pretty sure she wouldn't make it through the whole show because she had a terrible migraine headache, but she's soldiered on. And thank you, Pums, for being part of the show this morning. And it's very
and
good.
And we end just in time for school to start.
Yes. So now your real work begins. Richard, please keep writing your terrific books. And I would encourage anybody who heard any of what Richard said this morning, I'm sure you liked some of it, and if not all of it, you would want to read more from him. His book is called Seven Votes and is available now. Richard Stain has been our guest. This has also been The Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Thank you so much for being part of it. We will see you tomorrow morning, bright and early, at 6 a.m. Thank you, everybody. CliffCentral.com.